Welcome to In It to Win It. This is Steve Barton, and thank you for tuning in. As you can probably tell by my background here, we are talking with our resident uranium expert, Justin Hune. Justin, thanks for coming back on the show.
Good to see you, Steve. Yeah, happy to be back.
You as well, sir. You as well. I am feeling more and more confident about my uranium bets. I've got my bets are about 2% of my net worth now. So I'm feeling pretty happy with that. And I might actually increase it even more. What is your outlook for the short, medium, and long term in this sector?
Well, I guess if you say short term is what, maybe 6 months-ish, I would say that the outlook for the short term is very, very good. If you're talking about next week or even next month, I would not know what to tell you. I think that we're still, until we really see a strong breakout and much higher trading volumes across the uranium sector, we're still kind of beholden to the broad market. And I have no idea where that's going to go. I tend to think that if we haven't bottomed across markets, that maybe we'll have one more leg down. That's kind of just my gut feeling on that, based on a number of elements that I watch, although not that closely. I spend most of my time focusing on uranium. But if we're looking at, you know, let's say to 3 to 6 months, call that the short term, I'm very, very constructive on it. I think that based on the movement across the entire fuel cycle and the pressure that we're seeing on the enrichment and conversion aspects of the fuel cycle, that the uranium part of that is coming, and it's coming soon. And the fact that the spot market is tightening and actually moving up with SPUT almost essentially out of the spot market. I mean, they bought 300,000 pounds in July after buying more than 1 million pounds in June and buying 16 million pounds this year so far, year to date. They've been very quiet, yet the spot market is firming up and actually moving up. So that's a very good sign. And we just heard from Cameco's conference call that they've got more pounds in long-term contracts under discussion currently than at any time since Fukushima. And so we know now that the utilities definitely are in discussion for long-term contracts, to generalize. But that demand that's happening right now in conversion enrichment is going to happen in U308, and it's going to happen soon. So I honestly expect that to happen probably within 3 or 4 months. And I think that it will be significantly higher by year end. And then beyond that, let's say mid to long term, midterm would be what, 1 to 2 years, let's say. I think that's really the sweet spot. The long term, actually, in my opinion, is more of an iffy bet, only because, not because of any doubts I have about the nuclear sector. I actually think that the future of nuclear has never been brighter. And it's entirely possible that we have a very, very long bull market for the commodity and for nuclear in general. I just don't know how the world looks in 5 years and what the markets look like in 5 years, right? But that 12 to, let's say, 24 to 36 month range, I think we're going to see a bull market in uranium of epic proportions. I think it's going to rival the last bull market. Everything is setting up to support a very, very strong move for the commodity over that time frame.
Yeah, since we last talked, I sold some more oil and basically put it into uranium, and I'm feeling like an absolute genius because I did it right at that last bottom. Now we'll see if I get another shot. We'll see.
Nice.
Okay. Can we go into SMRs? So small modular reactors. You did an episode recently where it reminded me a lot of Pan American Silver. They've got 6 operating mines, and 2 of their deposits right now down in Guatemala and Argentina are, according to Rick Rule, completely not priced into the stock. And that was kind of your argument into SMRs, is nobody has added this into the price of uranium. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a new enough phenomenon, let's call it, that the market doesn't really know what to expect in terms of demand going forward. And it's far enough out that the market completely just kind of ignores its potential. And I think that that's slowly shifting now that we're starting to understand the potential implications on the supply and demand dynamic for uranium based on demand for SMRs, even starting as soon as, you know, 2028, 2029. The next decade could really be a phenomenal decade for nuclear, especially with SMRs, and could be demand that is far, far beyond anyone's wildest expectations. I think that that potential is absolutely there. I give a lot of credit to Art Hyde and the guys from Segra. They put out a piece last week that I strongly suggest to you and your listeners to check out if you haven't already, where they discuss more in depth the potential of SMRs, and they make a couple of really important points. One is that when any reactor is under construction, that many, many years prior to that reactor putting its initial core load of nuclear fuel into the reactor core, they are procuring uranium, and uranium obviously being the front end of that fuel cycle. So you'll have, you know, a large nuclear utility 5 or 6 years out from when that refueling is happening is when they start to look for the material in the market, with a cutoff of about 24 months before that refueling. And with an initial core load, it's potentially even more farther out on the curve. So if you have, let's say, you know, TerraPower's Natrium reactor that's set to be starting construction in the state of Wyoming, and this is just one example, for all I know, they already have their fuel sourced at this point, but perhaps not. But that construction is supposed to start 2025. With the startup of that SMR by 2028. I mean, that's the time frame they're putting out there right now. We'll see if they actually hit it. But if they actually start construction in 2025, you know for damn sure they're going to be out there getting that fuel ready for that. So the demand for these things that could be up and running 2028, 2029, 2030 is actually only a few years out from now. So that's one interesting point, is that fuel procurement really starts once once you have deals signed and construction timeframes planned out, that's when the demand actually hits. It's not when the SMR is up and running. So right. The demand hits years prior to the SMRs being up and running. So that's point one. Point two, which is very interesting, is that most of the SMR designs that are being engineered and proposed are going to be running on what's called HALEU, high assay, low enriched uranium. This is uranium that's enriched higher than, you know, your typical, you know, light water reactor, let's say 4.5% enriched uranium, but less than high enriched uranium, which is anything above 20% enrichment. So somewhere between that, and a lot of them are in the high teens in terms of enrichment for this HALEU nuclear fuel. And that does a number of things for the SMR. It will allow the SMR to run a bit more efficiently in terms of actual energy output from a smaller core. It will allow the reactor to operate for many, many years without a fuel reload. We're talking 5, 10, maybe even up to 20 years without having to refuel. But that means that initial core load is far greater in terms of uranium demand because of the higher enrichment levels. And so that has a bit of a compounding effect. Even if an SMR is 50 megawatts up to 350 megawatts, you know, and the typical large reactor is going to be around 1,000 megawatts or larger. Even though that is a much smaller capacity for these smaller reactors, the fact that they have much higher enriched uranium fuel, most of them do, and they operate for 10 plus, you know, up to 20 years without a refueling, that's a hell of a lot more uranium that needs to come on the front end for that initial core load and then for the future refueling. So the demand for SMRs is actually far more real and far more soon than most people think. And I do think whether or not we see it in the WNA's fuel report that will be out this year, at least in their higher scenario, they will probably start to bake in SMR demand towards the end of the decade. And I think that demand could actually potentially come sooner, judging by how quickly this technology is being embraced and adopted and being promoted, and the research is being done and on multiple continents. It's very exciting space.
Yeah. So what I hear you saying is there, they start buying this uranium, which is good for us as investors, way before they finish the construction project. And
oh yes,
what's that?
Oh yes, yeah. Way before, years before.
Okay, okay, that's cool. Now, a quick Google search told me that one of these can power a city of like 230,000 people. Is that accurate or?
It really depends on the size. They're all over the place. Yeah, I mean, there's micro SMRs that are going to be, you know, 5 to 10 megawatts that'll power, you know, a few hundred homes. Okay. And then there's, you know, 350. I think the Natrium reactor is 370 megawatts, if I recall correctly, and anywhere in between. And that will, you know, power a small city. So yeah, they're all over the place, and they're most of them are modular by design. So you know, SMRs, NuScale, their reactor, if I recall correctly, was, I believe, 70 something megawatts. But most of the deals that they're signing in these proposed projects are for 3 reactors, or for 6 reactors, or for 12 reactors, and they'll just, you know, plug them all in line with each other, so and stack them on top of each other, and you can really go up and down on that scale, which is so cool.
So you can go from really, really small community up to a population of 250,000 or
for sure
whatever you want. Okay, yep. That is pretty cool. Okay, and there's 3 major producers of these SMRs: Hyperion, Holtec, and NuScale.
Oh, there's dozens. Dozens. Yeah, yeah. Those 3 that you mentioned. TerraPower is a big one. Rolls-Royce is making them. GE Hitachi is making them. The Chinese are making them. And then there's probably another 20, 25 private companies that I'm not even aware of off the top of my head of their names. Oh yeah, the space is completely lighting up.
Nice.
Yeah. NuScale at this point is the only pure play that's publicly traded, but that's going to change. Somebody reached out to me yesterday working to finance a private SMR company that's going to be going public. You know, this is going to continue to grow for sure.
Okay. Good news. Good news. Okay. Kazatom Prom. We've talked about this one before. It's got a little hair on it. I asked Rick Rule about it, and he said, yeah, for some reason, people think that uranium that comes from the United States is somehow better than uranium that comes from Kazakhstan. They've recently, this last year or so, they've had declining outputs from their mines, correct?
Yeah, they just released their second quarter of this year operational update. They released that yesterday. They have year over year for the second quarter, the production is down 7%. Pretty significant for a producer of that size. I find that curious for a couple of reasons. One is that the type of mining that Kazatomprom does is ISR mining, right? So they in situ recovery. It's not a big open pit. It's not an underground mine. It's a series of wells, essentially, that go down into an aquifer that's held in an ore body that has good porosity, and there's, you know, relatively low grades of uranium, but the geology is such that they can inject sulfuric acid into the ore body and extract it, and that acid binds with the uranium, and they can produce an unbelievable amount of uranium in this manner, and they have, right? They're producing close to 60 million pounds a year, right? They're in the high 50s right now, 23,500 tons. It's just under 60 million pounds. I think they're going to miss that mark this year. But the interesting point is, actually, can I share my screen really quick?
Yeah.
So this is, can you see that?
I can see it.
This is a wellfield block production profile for Kazatomprom. And so the initial well drilling that takes a few months, then the piping well connection. So they actually will have to case those wells with PVC pipe. They'll have to get the whole setup there as far as the sulfuric acid injection, the recovery mechanisms in place on the recovery wells. And that whole process takes, 3 to 5 months, right? Just to do the well drilling and establishment of the wells. A couple more months for the actual acidification. So it takes some time to inject all the sulfur into the sulfuric acid into the ore body. And then the extraction process starts, and we're looking at, you know, 8 months before there's any production whatsoever from that series of well fields. Now when you go out to 12 months, now you're into production. You know, 10 to 14 months is really when production is ramping, and you go out to a year and a half and that series of wells is already peaking in production. So they have to be doing this all the time to maintain the production levels they're at. Constant well field development for Kazatomprom. So the interesting thing about this is that they don't drill a lot of wells in the winter. The winters in Kazakhstan are extremely harsh. They're very, very cold. So they do the least amount of well field drilling in January, followed by December and February in that order. So basically December through February, there's very little well field development for in Kazakhstan. Now, if we're talking about production Q2 being 7% lower, that means that the well field development in late Q1 to early Q3 of last year was insufficient, and or they perhaps did not have the sulfuric acid that they needed for that time period. Now, I speculated on this yesterday in my podcast because I was thinking about this. It's like, well, late Q1 to early Q3 of last year was about as normal as things have been over the last 3 years, which is saying a lot, right? Like, it's been couple of years between COVID and just geopolitical tension, the war in Ukraine, and all everything that's happening with inflation and supply chains and all that. Last year, especially considering that they had to essentially shut down their well field development for 6 months in 2020, you would have expected that decline in production to happen in 2021. We didn't see a lot of decline in production in 2021, a little bit, you know. But you would have thought that during 2021, they would have made up for lost time during those relatively normal months and either developed more or at least sufficiently to keep production up. So I find it very curious that production is down 7% in the second quarter relative to last year, all things considered. So I think that probably points to lower than expected production coming out of 2022 for Kazatomprom. And another noteworthy element of that release was that they mentioned that they'd been buying in the spot market. And so the fact that they're buying in the spot market kind of tells you a little bit about their production loss was probably unexpected, and they had to potentially do that. Whether that was to bolster inventories or actually to fill contracts, I don't know. They usually won't give that type of color. But their cost increases also were up over 30% year over year. And so part of that, I believe the spot market purchases get included in that cost structure. But either way, that's significant cost rising. So for the largest producer in the world of uranium, not only are they caught in between the West and Russia, which is probably not a very comfortable place to be, and they're having issues with transportation, but they're having production misses and they're having cost increases. So at the very least, this is pointing towards significantly higher pricing for the pounds coming out of Kazakhstan due to those cost increases and lower production. And it's also just it's a tricky place to be right now in geopolitically speaking. And I think that they're doing the best job that they can to kind of stiff Putin and maintain an image to the West that we are a reliable producer. We will figure out this transportation situation. They are looking at Western routes of going through the Caspian and the Black Seas rather than avoiding the port of St. Petersburg. Cameco mentioned in their conference call last week that they still have yet to receive any uranium from their JV Inkai project in Kazakhstan this year. So, but they did seem to think that within weeks they would have some updates on that Western route. So it's a very tumultuous jurisdiction. And the fact that it's been a very, very reliable producer for a very long time just adds to the difficulties for Western utilities right now in not only trying to sort out conversion and enrichment not coming from Russia, but their favorite and most prolific producer of U-308 is also kind of compromised as well. So yeah, pretty significant situation over there.
Yeah, so I hear you saying that if the biggest producer of uranium on the planet is having issues, that's going to reduce the supply. And when there's less supply and more demand, it drives up price.
100%. Yeah, and we know they're not the only one. I mean, Paladin came out with updated CapEx costs to bring Langerheinrich online, which they say still should be up and running by 2024. But those CapEx costs went from $87 million to $117 million, and that was from November until a few weeks ago. So in 8 months, their CapEx costs rose by 30-something percent, almost 40%. And same thing with MacArthur. You know, Cameco is a major company, been around forever. They've got these established mines. They have an established workforce. They've got supportive government. And they're bringing MacArthur River back online right now. And they expected to get 5 million pounds of production this year out of MacArthur. And now they're saying we'll be lucky to have 2 million. So it's, you know, it's we're now kind of living in this world where there's really not a whole lot that you can hang your hat on that's really guaranteed in terms of supply chains and production. And going forward, that is going to be security of supply, you know. And this is funny because it comes full circle back to Mike Alkin's, you know, talks when nobody gave a damn about uranium back in 2017. And you know, back in the day, he's still saying, you know, security of supply is paramount for utilities. And anytime that security of supply is threatened, utilities will do what they have to do to make sure they get the uranium they need to keep the plants online. We're talking about multi-billion dollar assets with sunk costs. You don't just let those things come offline because all of a sudden your input costs rise by a few percentage points. So security of the supply now for a lot of Western utilities looks like signing contracts, and that's what's coming.
Yeah, the supply chain issues are pretty impressive. I'm noticing that just with my ADU in the back. We were talking off air about me building the fence, and Home Depot didn't have price tags on the lumber because they didn't know what the price of lumber was that day. So you literally had to take a board up to the checker, and she would scan it, and then you write down what the price is of each one, take it back, and then figure out how you're going to build your fence. It's, it reminded me of stories from like Weimar Germany, and I'm like experiencing it here in my local Home Depot. It's pretty impressive. Okay. Politically, money, in the U.S. is going into, nuclear, correct? So we've got the, Inflation Reduction Act. I read in, the newspaper the other day that, politicians are trying to, fight inflation by giving everyone gas cards. What can you do but laugh, right? Here it says $369 billion in energy security and climate change programs over the next 10 years. Is it what of that is going into uranium? How will that affect the sector? What do you see there?
I don't think we actually know yet exactly how much is going into uranium. I believe that within the Build Back Better bill, and I don't, you know, that obviously got sidelined. I don't know if there's been funding allocated within this new bill for the federal strategic reserve of uranium. That was something that's been proposed for years and years and years. I think that might still be on the table, but it's kind of irrelevant because it's such a small amount of money that was last proposed, something to the tune of $70 million or something like that. And I think that would be an annually. So it's a pretty small amount of uranium, but what is in the proposal is federal tax credits for clean energy. And that includes nuclear. So that's a big deal. And that is on top of the funding that has already been allocated for saving nuclear plants that are on the cusp of profitability and potentially considering shutting down. So one example of that is Diablo Canyon in California, that's in our backyard, that has been slated to shut down forever. That's 2023, 2024, I believe, for the decommissioning of that reactor. And now they're actually trying to keep that online, and they have applied for that federal funding to support that reactor to stay online. So that's part of it. That's in addition to actual tax credits for nuclear finally being lumped in with all other forms of clean energy. I don't know why this wasn't obvious, you know, decades ago, but it better now than never, I suppose. So that's positive. There's also, still trying to figure out the finer details on this is the support from the DOE for HALEU. And so the DOE is recognizing that that HALEU is going to be needed for advanced reactors going forward. And it seems like there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of talk about new large nuclear plants in the United States. Currently, and probably a lot of that has to do with the Vogtle plant that's being built right now in Georgia. This plant has gone way, way, way over budget and way over in terms of timing on the timeline for the construction of this plant. So that probably has left a bad taste in everyone's mouth in terms of large reactors in the United States. And so the DOE and the Biden administration seems to be attaching, you know, kind of hitching their horse to the SMRs and the advanced nuclear. And they recognize that most of these designs, like we mentioned, are looking for HALEU fuel. And so it looks like the DOE might end up doing something similar to what is being proposed for the Strategic Uranium Reserve, which is they might be a buyer of HALEU and just saying like, hey, you've got us as a customer you can depend on. So go out and innovate and build what you need to build to create the capacity for that type of enrichment. So we have the Urenco facility in New Mexico. There's also Centrus. And between those two, potentially also GLE, Global Laser Enrichment, which is Silex and Cameco. There's a facility that's proposed in Paducah in the States, and they would be able to re-enrich tails and to the tune of a few million pounds a year, but that probably won't start for quite a few years going out if it does. So a lot of potential balls spinning on there, but they're supporting HALEU production in the United States, generally speaking. So all of those elements definitely seem to be overall positive in acknowledging the importance of the existing nuclear fleet, recognizing that SMRs and advanced nuclear should be part of the grid going forward, and also doing what they can to actually support the innovation around enrichment into HALEU fuel for this advanced reactors and SMRs.
Yeah, so basically anything that the government can do to give out tax credits or anything to these guys would be beneficial for us in our picks.
For sure, yeah. I think, you know, and I think that as far as uranium investment goes, you know, you can invest in Cameco and SLX for the Global Laser Enrichment. You can invest in Centrus. You can invest in SMR, NuScale. These are all companies based, well, except for Cameco, and I guess Silex is on the ASX, but the operations are in the States, but most of the investment potential for uranium in the States is uranium miners. So, you know, on a positive note, the uranium miners in the States seem to be increasing in favor to the utilities because it's right here. And the U.S. has such a large nuclear fleet. The U.S. Utilities, generally speaking, are less covered in terms of their nuclear fuel needs going out into the future relative to the European nuclear utilities. So things look brighter for U.S. uranium miners going forward.
Okay. I get a lot of guys with their 401ks and Roth IRAs, and I've been doing this for years. And I was pretty unpopular since the COVID crash, and I've become more and more popular to get advice after quarter one, and especially now after quarter two, they realize that those bets are probably not where you want to be anymore. And I'm kind of running into some roadblocks with some of these because, Girlfriend's Count, for example, she only had 31 funds that she could invest in with her 401k. We were able to move that over to a different one. And the gal on the phone said, oh, well, we can only invest in ETFs through this thing. But lucky for you, there's 9,500 ETFs, American ETFs that you can invest in. And I didn't want to argue with her on the phone, but I don't even think there's 9,500 ETFs on the planet. But anyhow, if you were a guy that was doing this and you only had ETFs to go on, URNM would be number one, correct? And URA would be two, or?
Can you trade options?
No. You can't even buy BHP or Wheaton Precious Metals or Rio Tinto. It's strictly ETFs.
Only ETFs.
Yeah.
Only ETFs. Yeah, no, that would be URNM because they're pure play.
Okay.
And they've outperformed URA during this bull market so far.
Okay. For the precious metal sector, I got them thrown in, depending on the risk tolerance, GDX, GDXJ, SIL, SILJ, URNM, URA. And then right now, our allocation was 40% cash until the last couple of weeks. We've dropped that down to 30% cash. What's your cash position right now? I'm almost thinking 30% might be a little light. A little heavy.
Yeah, my cash position is less than that. For our model portfolio, our uranium portfolio for the newsletter, we're 100% invested right now.
Wow.
But
okay.
That isn't, we don't ever suggest that everyone put all of their money into uranium. So
yeah,
that goes along with an assumption that you have cash or you have other investments as well.
Yes.
So that's a big, fat, giant, bold, blinking disclaimer. With that said, I'm mostly invested right now. I do have, I have a hedge on or two, with put spreads that are shorter dated. They're shorter. So that's the spread reduces the cost of just buying straight puts, which are unbelievably expensive for anything with any great liquidity like the S&P. So if you want to short the market, I prefer to use put spreads, and I'll do it on shorter dates because I personally do think that if we see further weakness, it's probably going to be shorter lived. I'll have a put spread on that has an October, November expiry. And then I just hold my uranium longs. I don't like to trade these. I don't like to miss the boat. I don't personally like the pressure of trying to time intracycle tops and bottoms. And for me, I hate chasing. So I am much more comfortable keeping a decent amount of cash. So in my portfolio that's uranium and precious metals, like resource base, oil, I have some oil stuff as well. You know, that's maybe 10% cash, probably a little bit less, but I also have those hedges. So if everything gets all crashy in the next 6 weeks or something like that,
yeah,
I'm just going to hold my longs and ride it out. And that put spread will 3X and I'll cash it out and I'll put more cash into my longs. I don't want to create a tax event by trying to trade. And I don't want the pressure of trying to go in and out of these things, because when they move so hard and so fast. And I really, really hate chasing. And that, yeah, you know, and that's just me. This isn't advice. This is not suggesting to anybody what to do, because some people really love to trade and that's their bread and butter, is trading in and out. And I know a number of these people on Twitter and they do it very well. And that's great. All the better for them. Most of them are not based in the United States, probably have different capital gains laws. So for me, if I try to time something and I trade out of it, I trigger a tax event. I have to pay taxes on that next year. And I reset that clock. So if I want to get back in, not only do I have to try to time that re-entry to make it worthwhile for the profits I booked and the taxes I'm going to pay, but I also have to consider that, let's say I go back long again now, and for some reason I want to get out of that stock in the next 12 months. Well, now I'm paying short-term capital gains, which for my tax bracket is about double what the long-term capital gains are. That sucks. So for me, I stay long on my holdings that I have a long-term vision for. I buy when they're red. I buy when they're weak. I nibble. I like call spreads. I have a lot of call spreads in the uranium space. And if I'm feeling bearish across markets, I'll put on a put spread, and those spreads I'll trade. So I don't do like a 2024 put spread and hope to have long-term capital gains on that. No, I'm trying to not only buffer the volatility in the portfolio, but also potentially create some cash to put back in it. And if things shoot up, well, I'm 95% long, and I'll cover my put spread at a 50% loss, and I don't really care. So that's kind of how I roll personally.
Okay. I do the same kind of thing with like a 2 or 3X bear. I haven't done it with uranium, but with the
bearish ETF.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Can you pull up the two graphs we talk about? So this is going to be URNM versus the S&P 500, and then URA versus the S&P 500. So it kind of gives you an idea of how these two ETFs are performing against the S&P 500?
Sure. Well, this definitely is still clearly in that uptrend on a relative basis. We can't go back that far because URNM just, you know, started just prior to 2020. But this low, when we lost that trend line, so bear bull market started back here, December 2020. We dipped and hit it in last summer, dipped and hit it again late January, early February, and we dipped again. Now we have this undercut low. And interesting about this undercut low, across the entire space, no matter what uranium equity you looked at, and of course, this is a relative chart, but still, this lower low that just happened in July, there was unbelievably clear positive divergence in the RSI. And to me, that was, you know, for me, I keep technical charting very, very simple. I don't honestly put a lot of faith in trend lines. I like to watch the moving averages and volume more than anything. But this was such an obvious trend line that I was like, okay, if we get back down near that or even break below that, that's probably a really awesome buying opportunity. So far, that has played out. Will it continue to play out? I don't know. I'm hoping that it does. But that was a clear, this lower low with positive divergence. And I mean, we can see that everywhere. I mean, it was all over the place. I mean, it was a next gen, these lower lows, big positive divergence. And then we've seen a huge move. And I mean, next gen went from 340 to 427. It's up 30% in the last 3 weeks. And that one got beat up more than most. But URNM relative to the S&P, I think, is an interesting chart. One other one I've been watching, Steve, is URNM relative to the spot price of uranium. And this one was a screaming buy a few weeks ago. And the reasoning was, I drew this line back. Not only was this resistance in September of 2020, but this is when the bull market broke out right here. This is December of 2020. This is your bull market breakout right there. Okay. Yeah. We were at those valuations 3 weeks ago relative to the metal. So it was almost like a complete reset of the uranium bull market. And I was so excited to see that. I got pretty long. I got pretty aggressive in some call spreads and added to my long, just common stock positions at 3 weeks ago. And this also not quite as obvious, but still, you know, slightly lower low here, moving up on the RSI. And again, this is a relative chart compared to the commodity, but relative to the commodity, we were back as if the bull market had never happened. And when I couple that with my confidence about what's about to happen in the uranium market, that to me was an unbelievable excuse to get more exposure, which I did.
Yeah, that I didn't know about this graph, but that's amazing. That's pretty much when I think it was simply because quarter two had come out and they were you know, seeing that their portfolio was down by 20%+. And happened to coincide timely with this timing here. So that's outstanding.
Yep. Yeah. Yes. We're actually pretty close to break even here year to date after getting a pretty good washout over the past few months. And we had a good rally in April. So, you know, the fact that we're break even here shows you how deep we went over the past few months, but all things considered, year to date, it hasn't been a terrible year. And I think honestly, what's coming in the second half of the year, we're very likely to have a pretty strong year again after we were, let's see, 2021, we were up 128%, I think, for the year. So I don't think we're probably not going to hit that for 2022, would be my guess. But I do think we'll be positive double digits.
Nice.
Yeah. Nice. So this chart is fantastic. If I can show you one more, we are hitting a little bit of resistance here potentially, and I expected a small pullback. We got that for a day. Most of the stocks in the space are green today, which is nice to see. But one more I would say is URA relative to the S&P, because we can go back further into the past. Similar looking chart.
Been around a lot longer.
Yes. Similar looking chart in the shorter term of the past couple of years to URNM relative to the S&P. And URNM has outperformed the URA since the bull market began. But I mean, this has been a forever downtrend. I mean, I zoom out so much, it's not even going to look like we're in an uptrend now. Yeah. But you can clearly see this is just a giant, giant kind of rounding bottom with very early stages of outperformance. And I think this is going to just explode to the upside at some point.
I agree. It looks like someone started drawing a U and only got about 60% of the way through it. And we got the other 40% to go.
Totally.
Yes.
This is kind of a curious chart too. I haven't looked at this one recently. Cameco, that generally over a long period of time looks to basically move in line with the commodity. But now we're outperforming it and we're moving up pretty significantly. I think Cameco is really kind of in the catbird seat here. Very curious to see this kind of big bull flag is what it looks like to me.
Yeah, I see the same.
Maybe a bull pennant, excuse me. Looking forward to seeing that break out, and I think that it will.
Yeah. Well, for my sake, I hope it has another pullback. I could get more. Yeah, I'm maybe 30% is too high, and that's just of investable assets in the account. Certainly not considering the
total. Sure, I mean, look, there's nothing wrong with keeping a strong cash position because you never know if there's some kind of exogenous event. I mean, there's so much volatility in the world right now too. It's like, anything could happen that could cause the markets to have a swift, drawdown. And if you've got cash, then you're stoked. And if you don't, you're kind of bummed.
Yeah.
So it's good to have something. It's always good to keep a decent amount of cash handy for those type of events. Even if the bull market takes off and totally rips and roars, if you got 10 or 20% cash, you're still mostly long. You still have a lot of exposure. There's nothing wrong with that and buffering the volatility a bit and keeping some for a rainy day. And then you always have options. I mean, that's the thing. That's the great thing about vertical call spreads is like, you can grasp an amazing amount of leverage without feeling like you're chasing. And that, I don't know. That's why I like them so much. Like I've already told you, I really, really, really hate to chase stocks. So for me, and this might just be my own mental block. It's like, I cannot buy something at an all-time high. And I know technical traders that exclusively buy all-time highs and do very well. I can't do it. Regardless, no matter how great the fundamental case is, I can't buy an all-time high. I just have this contrarian mindset. But if we've got Cameco 30% off the recent lows, I'll absolutely buy into a vertical call spread because I can play around with the strikes and the expirations and get 2, 3, 4, 5x if I'm right, and buffer that volatility by shorting the out of the money calls. It's a great strategy. It's a really, really great arrow to have in your quiver.
Yes. Well, very cool. Thank you, Justin. And please like and subscribe. We're almost at 1,000 YouTube subscribers. If you're a listener on the podcast, we got a few thousand over there. If you do me a favor, click over in the link in the show notes, go to YouTube and just hit subscribe. That should jumpstart the algorithm and get us over the hump. And Justin, thank you. You can go to uraniuminsider.com for all things Justin and uranium, and check out his YouTube channel where you publish almost daily your videos, Uranium Market Minute. Thanks again for coming on the show, Justin. You have a great rest of the day.
My pleasure. Yeah, you do the same, Steve. Thank you.